When you buy LG, you get so much more than just an appliance. You get more done, more cost savings, more peace of mind, and more control. Because LG appliances are designed to do more. Like washers and dryers with AI tech to take out the guesswork. Refrigerators that fit in tight spaces and keep food fresher longer. Or ranges with precise induction cooking and easy cleanup built in. All with the style you want and reliability you can count on. So you can get more from your home every day. LG appliances, so much more. Make life easier with LG. See the latest models and savings now at LG.com.
Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. In the Isabella Stewart Gardner Art Museum in Boston, the first thing you notice is the magnificent courtyard, which is a lush, verdant, romantic setting that feels like it belongs to the Montagues or the Capulets in Italy during the Renaissance, situated inside a balconied palazzo owned by a family of wealth and taste. Really, do yourself a favor and Google the courtyard there. I've never been in person, but it's now my mental happy place based on the photos alone. Now, the second thing you notice about the museum is that some of the rooms in that four-story house, it was, in fact, the wealthy and spirited Mrs. Gardner's home before it was a museum, have empty frames on the wall where you would expect to find some piece of astonishing art. But most who visit know this is because on the morning of March 18, 1990, 13 works of art from Mrs. Gardner's dazzling collection were taken and have not been found. Not a one.
The gates at the Isabella Gardner Museum will stay locked while authorities search for clues in the daring weekend heist.
There are some significant paintings missing. By significant, there's a couple of Rembrandts and a Vermeer.
That was a CBS News report back on March 19th, 1990. You might be wondering why the frames remained. We're not totally certain. Sure, it's tough hauling out framed artwork from a museum without being noticed, so it's possible the thieves had thought better of that and had knifed, really, the irreplaceable masterpieces out of their frames to better abscond with them. Although, that can't be the whole story, because one of the pieces of artwork was as small as a postage stamp. The stolen works included three Rembrandts, including his only seascape, Christ on the Storm on the Sea of Galilee, Johann Vermeer's The Concert, one of only 34 known paintings by that Dutch master, a series of equine sketches by Edgar Degas, a portrait by Edward Manet, and a 1638 landscape by Govert Flink. The thieves also took a Shang Dynasty Gu, a bronze vessel used in Chinese rituals 1200 years before the Common Era, and a filial from a Napoleonic flag which someone recently valued at a less than impressive 10 or 15 bucks. The rest of the artworks were valued at the time at much higher than that.
Ballpark figure on the cost is about $200 million.
And that figure has grown. The New York Times recently valued them at something like $1.2 billion. Now, if you listen to this tomorrow, they'll be worth even more than that, because valuable art only gets more valuable by the day, especially since these works have not been seen for 34 years. So Spoiler alert, the Gardner heist has not been solved, and no one has been charged with the crime, though not for lack of trying or lack of reward. The original $1 million reward, Sotheby's and Christie's auction houses put up that money, has ballooned to what is now a $10 million reward offered by the FBI for a tip that leads to the safe recovery of the art. The museum does not care if the thieves are found, just bring back the art. Now the FBI, on the other hand, does care. The reward would seem to be mighty enticing, but this caper, which horrified the art world and fascinated the rest of it, may have involved the Boston Mafia, both branches, the Italians and the Irish, a famous art thief, or idiots, or all of the above. It began in the very early morning of May 18th, a day when all St. Patrick Day festivities that Irish and non-Irish citizens enjoy were set to unfold in South Boston. It was no wonder a few high schoolers had drunk a bit much on the 17th and, around midnight, were walking down Palace Road near the Gardner when one of them spotted two police officers in a small gray hatchback. One cop looked sort of stocky, the other looked skinny and wore glasses. It was raining, but not hard, and the kids got a good look because they wanted to be sure they were cops, and then they wanted to be sure to steer clear of them. The cops didn't seem that interested in the kids or their shenanigans. They stayed put in the unlikely car, and the kids moseyed on. A half hour later, those guys dressed as cops pressed the buzzer at the museum's side entrance. The security guard on duty obeyed orders when the cops said, "Police, let us in. We heard you had a disturbance." Richard Abbath, 23 years old and more college dropout and hippie musician than security detail, buzzed them in. He had already given his two-week notice, by the way. He told the museum the job was getting in the way of his frequent gigs. The museum's guards had been directed not to let anybody in, ever. But Abbath had broken the rules before, having let friends in for a party once, and it's the cops this time, and nobody had ever told him what to do if the cops showed up. So, you know. The two cops approached his desk and asked him to bring any other on-duty guards down to the desk so they could all chat. The only guy besides Abbath was 25-year-old Randy Hestand, who was doing this overnight shift for the first time that night. An older guard had called in sick, and Hestand said he would come in. And now, just as he showed his face, one of the cops put both guards in handcuffs. They said, "This is a robbery." The two guards were taken to the basement of the museum. The robbers handcuffed one to a workbench, the other to a steam pipe. They wound duct tape around their hands and heads, making sure to cover their eyes and mouths. Like in a bad movie, the cops told the guards not to say anything. Quote, "We know where you live," end quote. All of this took a little time, but no one was expected at the museum until about 8 a.m. The thieves were free to browse, somehow having known that Abbath had not pushed the red panic button under the counter and that the real cops were not on their way. But they mostly seemed to know what they wanted and, frankly, what they didn't. Later, the FBI, the Boston police, private investigators, museum professionals, and casual art lovers wondered why the thieves took certain things and left things of much greater value than the drawings or the goo. Look, they left such goodies as Michelangelo's 1540 drawing of his Pietà, Raphael's Lamentations over the Dead Christ, Henri Matisse's The Terrace, Saint-Tropez, 1904, and Titian's Rape of Europa. They had clean access to all of these pieces. All they had to do was climb a flight of stairs and look around. Everything was labeled, and they had plenty of time. Afterward, everyone was flummoxed. Why did they spend valuable minutes unscrewing and removing a valueless item like a flag filial and taking the frame off the Rembrandt self-portrait, a piece of art that was no bigger than a postage stamp, when they could have pocketed the whole thing easily. It seemed they had come into the museum with a shopping list, from which they did not veer. In all, these guys spent 81 minutes in the museum, and despite many missed opportunities, theirs remains the biggest art heist in modern history. The first time the world was alerted to the Gardner Museum theft was when it was time to change guard shifts, and no one answered the door when the morning shift showed up. Soon enough, the cops arrived to find the place in a horrible mess. They alerted the FBI and found the guards, still alive, in the basement. After the shock of the thing, a few questions immediately rose beyond the peculiarity of what had been stolen. Questions like, who were these guys? Why were they allowed in? Was it an inside job? Why not kill the witnesses? Who were the people who had commissioned this crime? The high-profile nature of the heist meant that you couldn't sell the art on the open market, so a buyer must have asked specifically for those items, so who would want these things? And most importantly, who was that end buyer, and where was the art now? Martin Lepo, a criminal defense attorney for many of the mafia types who would later be suspected of being involved, talked to the Barnacle brothers for a Netflix documentary called This Is a Robbery.
Why do people steal artwork? Well, there's a number of reasons. You get it because you want to continue to look at it. You want the reward for it. You want the insurance money. You want to save yourself from going to jail. You want to get somebody out of jail. So it's a good bartering piece.
The first is a possibility. The second, well, no one has ever inquired about the reward. You can discount the insurance money angle. The gardener was insured for most everything, except, you know, theft. Now the last reason seems likely. More than once in the history of art theft, especially in the United States, and most particularly in the case of a famous Boston art thief named Miles Connor Jr., thieves have taken art to use as a get-out-of-jail-free card. Lepo was Connor's attorney, and the FBI was very familiar with Connor. But Connor was in federal prison at the time of the robbery, which didn't completely exonerate him, but it took the spotlight off him. So, who were these guys? The videotape that would have shown their faces was taken by the thieves. So, too, the printout of where and when each alarm in each room of the museum had been breached. By the time the FBI got there, the place had been overrun by Boston police and museum personnel. Now, it's maybe understandable that the place wasn't scoured for DNA, because DNA was just starting to be used in trials, but fingerprint comparisons had been around for decades, so I can't explain why no one saved the duct tape that had been used on the guards. Later, with the help of a hard drive that recorded breaches in each of the rooms in the museum, the authorities could track how the robbery had progressed, which room they entered, and how long they spent there. An odd fact here. Of the 81 minutes in the museum, 48 were not in places where alarms went off. Where were they? What were they doing? They did spend some time in various rooms on the second floor, seemingly having never moved to the first, which was odd because the Manet was taken from the first floor. Its frame was found in the guard area, on the chair of the guy who was head of security. That put Abbath front and center as a suspect straight away because, per the alarm records, he was the last person in the short gallery at 12:24 before the robbery began, where the Manet had hung. And he had just given notice. Could be he just didn't much like the head of security, and this was his way of saying so. Despite these facts, Abath was cleared eventually of any participation in the crime, partly because it turned out that the security system inside the museum wasn't all that reliable. Staffers reported sometimes walking into a room just to see if the alarm went off, and sometimes it didn't. Anne Hawley, the museum director who had been on the job for only 6 months when the theft occurred, explained that cutting the art free of the frame is a time-consuming job and especially destructive.
It was incomprehensible to me that even if you were wanting to steal art, that you would treat it that way. In terms of art historical works, the most important work lost is the Rembrandt Seascape. And that was brutally cut out of the frame.
What made the blood of those who know about 600-year-old masterpieces run cold was this. You cut it out of its frame and you roll it up to move it easily, and the tube you put it in is likely not acid-free, and you put it in the back of a van where it jostles around and you are just killing it with every step. You've ripped the canvas and torn the sides. The painting is old and is cracking off as you peel it off its moorings. You roll paint that hasn't been anything but flat for centuries, and it flakes unmercifully. It's been preserved in some way. The Gardner Museum did not then have climate or humidity-controlled facilities, as most major museums did. And now you've got heat on in the car while it continues to rain outside on that March morning. Geez, Louise, talk about depreciation. Not to mention desecration. Shelley Murphy, a Boston Globe reporter, also known for her work on the Mafia Don Whitey Bulger, has followed the crime for 34 years. Early on, she reported the FBI was looking into possible mafia involvement from either or both of Boston's crime families. One, the Irish, had routinely sent money and arms to Northern Ireland to help the Irish Republican Army. The other, the Italian, always wanted to make money or acquire some collateral for dealing with law enforcement.
Boston's a small town. Everybody's related. Didn't you know that? Of course there are people that were in the museum that had mob ties. Who didn't, right? I think that a lot of people had access to that place.
And a lot of people knew how vulnerable it was to being robbed. In 1981, mobster Ralph Rossetti and art thief Louis Royce were under surveillance while they were casing the Gardner. They weren't caught actually doing anything chargeable, but the FBI told the museum that it needed more safeguards against theft. Then nothing happened. Well, until 1990, of course. But that was far enough removed from the casing that it seemed unrelated. The FBI ran out of leads and ideas pretty fast after the Gardner heist. The caper initially had 45 agents assigned to it, but soon that number dwindled to just one agent, a guy who was only 26 years old. It seemed the FBI gave up. The Boston media, however, was never going to let this one go. For the record, the Irish mob denied all involvement. So did the IRA. And there was nothing about the heist to suggest that either was involved. The Italians were a different story. The influx of drugs into the country was rampant by then, and two different families were fighting for control of the Boston market. The killings and violence threatened law-abiding Boston. The Fed stepped in and vowed to destroy the Cosa Nostra there. They had recently nabbed wise guy Vince Ferreira for some vicious murders, among other things. Maybe the theft was a way to buy him a ticket out of jail. Stephen Kirkajan, investigative reporter for the Globe and author of Master Thieves about the heist, noted that Ferreira's driver and best bud was named Bobby Donati, a violent thug who allegedly had done some work with art thief Miles Connor in the past. That work was a burglary that netted art and art objects from the Woolworth Estate in rural Maine. That theft included three works by N.C. Wyeth and one from his son, Andrew. Donati visited Ferreira in jail once before the thefts and twice after. Later, Ferreira would say that Donati told him that he had helped engineer the Gardner theft in order to get Ferreira free. He offered no proof. Bobby Donati couldn't speak for himself. His body was found beaten, stabbed, and decapitated before being stuffed into the trunk of his Cadillac in September 1991. But that didn't keep Donati's name from coming up as reporters and investigators tried to unravel the Gardner mystery, especially since Donati was seen with a paper bag stuffed with Boston police uniforms just prior to the March 18th heist. And once it was assumed Donati was in on the thing, leads started to pick up about what Donati might have done with the art. Because Donati knew Connor, it was postulated that Donati had permission to hide things on Connor's land where he kept horses. There were also tractor trailers and a few ragged sheds on the property, all big enough for the purpose. While in prison, Connor had left his stuff to be protected by recent parolee William Youngworth III, who proved to be less than helpful to Connor. Once on Connor's land, Youngworth got to snooping and began selling off Connor's collection of swords and other various pieces of art that Connor had stashed. We're talking gobs of it. That was apparently to fund a drug problem. When word reached Connor, he ended their friendship, but that didn't obliterate their tie in the eyes of the law. Seems that Youngworth had been an early suspect in the 1990 Gardner crime. On paper, he made a lot of sense. He and Connor had been friends for years. He claimed he'd once stolen another Rembrandt painting from the Boston Museum of Fine Art in 1975 to broker Connor's release from prison, which worked. At the time of the Gardner heist, he called himself an antique dealer and an art dealer, and was known to have mafia connections. He seemed a great fit. But there was a problem. He was incarcerated when the heist happened.
The first time I was directly confronted by any law enforcement entity behind the Gardner robbery was approximately 72 hours after the robbery occurred, when agents accused me of knowing something about the robbery. When I asked them, why are you here asking me about this? I mean, I'm sure you noticed those guard towers and the men with the guns and the razor wire and all the fences you had to pass through to come in here and accuse me of this. I assure you, they don't give you weekend passes to go out and rob things here. They found that a bit amusing. One of the agents said, hey, Bill, you know what? There's just not a lot of people that do this type of thing. It's a short list and you're on the top of it.
The FBI got warrants to search Connor's property for Gardner loot. They came up empty. Youngworth, though, had tipped off Tom Mashberg at the Boston Herald that he had information about where the missing art was now residing. The reporter and Youngworth traded teasing phone calls until one day, Mashberg said they weren't going to talk anymore without some proof. Show me a canvas. Youngworth took the bait and invited Mashberg along for a midnight drive to Red Hook, New York, to a storage facility where Youngworth opened a locker. He opened it, rummaged around, and pulled something out of a large tube. He gave Mashberg a flashlight, which the news guy shined over the unfurled canvas, and lo, it looked for all the world like Rembrandt's Storm of the Sea of Galilee, crumbling pieces of ancient paint and all. Mashberg, being a good reporter, then contacted the gardener, sitting down with a bevy of experts who quizzed him about every aspect of what he saw. It all fit. Then Mashberg asked Youngworth for photographs, and in return, he got negatives that showed the artwork. The FBI remained skeptical, though. Then Mashburg asked for paint samples, which were delivered to his office and immediately sent to the world's foremost expert on paint age and paint availability and usage in 1633. The electron microscope does not lie. The chip was appropriate to the era. Was Youngworth showing Mashburg proof? Was he about to make a deal? Was the very large 63-inch by 50-inch Storm coming home? No. Upon more investigative work, the paint chip was shown to contain a color called Red Lake, which was never used by Rembrandt. Sorry. The FBI said this was extortion. No deal. I know this has all been complicated, so a quick recap. The FBI had thought Bobby Donati had been in on the Gardner Museum theft. Donati knew Miles Connor, who was prone to stashing stolen paintings on his property, and William Youngworth III had at some point been tasked with overseeing that property while Connor was in prison. That apparently incongruent red paint chip, the one known not to have been used by Rembrandt, sank this theory. But Bobby D's name kept popping up. There was one guy who considered Donati to be like a son. His name was Bobby Guarente, who was a relative, by the way, of Ralph Rossetti, he of the 1981 casing of the Gardner, which prompted the FBI warning about security, which went unheeded. I now know why the term thick as thieves came into being. Anyway, Guarente hung out at the TRC body shop in Dorchester, a place once referred to in print as, quote, an underworld flea market for looted goods, end quote. And that shop was owned by a Godfather-type guy named Carmelo Marino, who, it is said, may have hatched the whole Gardner Museum caper from inside the body shop while shooting the shit with junior thugs David Turner, George Reisfelder, Lenny DiMuzio, and Charlie Pappas. So a new theory formed, one that viewed the heist through a whole new lens. Maybe investigators have been giving the thieves too much credit. Maybe the worthless things that were taken weren't personally important to them, but rather, maybe they were just idiots who had a list of a few items to take and then palmed a few others on the way out because they thought those things looked cool or something. Viewed through that lens, these guys, the junior thugs, fit the description of the kind of guys who pulled off the world's greatest art heist. That is, unprofessional, sloppy, and slow. The Netflix documentary included this great mix of contemporary reporters talking about the ridiculousness of the heist back when it happened.
Even at a time when art prices are setting records, dealers and curators say these paintings would be difficult to fence. Many believe they were hired to steal what they took.
But unless they already had a buyer lined up, it may have been one of the dumber robberies in recent history.
Given that these pieces are very well known, who could possibly keep them?
That's a very good question. Only probably a person who is determined to keep them private for the rest of their life.
Some of the masterpieces are so valuable, they may be too hot to sell, which raises the question, were these thieves working for a collector?
Now, in fairness, David Turner was a head above his thug colleagues. He would later manage to rob a Brinks truck for $500,000, and though he was caught, that was a pretty clean crime scene. But the other three, Reisfelder, DiMuzio, and Pappas, were the kind of guys more likely to have done the grunt work. Investigators theorized that maybe after they hightailed it out of Gardner, they passed the art on as soon as was humanly possible to more sophisticated guys like Turner and Guarente, who drove it out of Boston that night. Or maybe they were not that organized at all and just got lucky pulling off the heist, and they had no idea what to do with the art, so they hid it until things cooled down, which they soon discovered was not ever going to happen. Or maybe it wasn't them at all. Maybe it was still Rossetti and Royce, the guys who had cased the joint years earlier. Perhaps they'd been careful and patient enough to wait almost a decade before deciding to pull it off. Investigative reporter Stephen Kirkajan always thought so. The little pieces still all had to fit before the U.S. attorney would file charges. And there were, and still are, a whole lot of little pieces. Let's start with Donna Reisfelder, the sister-in-law of George, one of the junior thugs. She told the documentary makers for Netflix that George was the sweetest guy. He had served 16 years in prison for a murder for which he was later exonerated and really didn't carry that much of a grudge about it. By the way, his court-appointed lawyer in that 1966 case was John Kerry, a man who was U.S. Secretary of State from 2013 to 2017 and ran as the Democratic nominee for president in 2004, but lost to the incumbent, George W. Bush. Reisfelder's sister-in-law said that he drove a gray or blue hatchback at the time when he asked her to come over to his apartment and help him hang a picture. This was likely in 1990 sometime. She didn't much care for the picture, which was hung in what she called a foo-foo frame, gold with lots of smudges, too girly, she thought, for a guy to put over his bed, but he liked it. She asked if it was a sketch of him. He told her no. Later, she would identify it as Edward Manet's Chaise Tortoni, a piece she liked to call tortellini. When she heard later that one of the Gardner thieves had repeatedly returned to the guards handcuffed in the basement to ask if they were comfortable or needed water, she said that sounded like the good-hearted Reisfelder, who died of cocaine ingestion in March 1991. The picture that had hung above his bed went missing at the same time. Now, I mentioned earlier that David Turner was a bit smarter than your average mafia soldier. But it's worth noting, too, that he was not a nice man. In June of 1991, he shot junior thug Lenny DiMuzio in the head in Turner's backyard and then shoved the body into a car trunk and left it in a pizzeria parking lot for months until they found whatever was left to find of him in that trunk. Junior thug Charlie Pappas turned government informant on a different case and was scheduled to testify when he was shot and killed in 1995. Turner was finally convicted of planning a robbery of an armored car depot, which was foiled by the FBI. According to the Associated Press, the FBI told Turner that he would get a break if he helped them solve the Gardner case. At the time of his sentencing, Turner wrote a letter to Boston Magazine. Quote, "They think that I was the person who committed the robbery. They thought that if I was facing serious charges, I would be motivated to help facilitate the return of the paintings. Well, they got the serious charges against me, and now I'm going to die in prison," end quote. I can't say I'm crying for the guy. It's rumored that in 2004, Bobby Garante was negotiating to tell something he knew about the robbery or retrieve something to trade for release of his almost son, David Turner. Bobby Garante's wife was known to have said on occasion, quote, "My Bobby has some of those pictures," end quote. Then her Bobby died, having told no one anything. Maybe. In 2010, Turner wrote a letter to known made man Bobby Gentile, asking him to help recover the paintings, as it was believed by many that Gentile knew more than he was telling. Strangely, in 2016, Turner's 38-year sentence had been secretly reduced by 7 years, sparking speculation that maybe he had told somebody something. This despite the FBI's efforts to drill down on all of the Gentile leads, including that he had taken possession of some of the art through his relationship with Bobby Garante. Gentile failed the FBI's polygraph so badly that warrants were issued to search his home in 2010. Employing ground-penetrating radar, The search was thorough enough to find a deep hole dug under the floor of a backyard shed. Law enforcement were ecstatic, prompting Ryan McGeegan, Gentile's attorney, to remark on the craziness of it all.
And I looked at it and said, it's an empty hole. What do you want from me? And they said, well, we think that your client might have put the paintings in here. And I said, this Storm of the Sea of Galilee is 5x4. It's not going to fit in there. What are you talking about? Well, the small Rembrandt could have. And I said, yeah, but are you really looking for the small Rembrandt?
The small Rembrandt was the one that was postage stamp sized. The hole actually contained some firearms. Investigators moved to search inside the house, where they found a large plastic bin, inside of which was a newspaper clipping all about the Gardner Museum heist. And inside of that was a list of the works stolen from the museum, annotated with their estimated 1990 value. This looked bad, but wasn't enough to indict anybody. Later, McGeegan told a story about how Gentile was apparently on his deathbed, with doctors explaining how he would not live through the night. McGeegan told Gentile he could get him airlifted out of there so he could die at home with his beloved wife by his side if he would just tell him what he knew about the Gardner art. Gentile said he had nothing to tell him. That convinced McGeegan that Gentile really didn't know where the art went. In March of 2013, the FBI announced they had identified the two quote-unquote cops who had ransacked the Gardner Museum and made off with millions of dollars in art. They declined to name them as they deemed it an ongoing investigation. In March of 2015, despite no real movement in the case, the FBI changed its mind and named George Reisfelder and Lenny DiMuzio as the two men who robbed the museum. Both men were long dead by then. A tip to the museum was turned over to officials who now believe the gunning down of Jimmy Marks, Boston area career criminal at his home in 1991, may be linked to the robbery. Seems that Marks had been overheard bragging about possessing two of the stolen paintings, according to Edmund Mahoney of the Boston Herald. Marks is also said to have hidden some of the other artwork taken that night. So we have yet another wise guy to throw into the mix. Marks was a friend to Bobby Garante, who some postulated, along with fellow mobster Bobby Donati, might have driven the painting out of Boston to Connecticut and on to Philadelphia. Marks had spent time in prison for a bank robbery in the 1960s and knew something about how to take things that were not his. The Gardner Museum of Art has a security director now, whose job it is to collect tips and sift through information and try to connect the dots. Anthony Amore has a database with more than 1,000 names and 2,000 addresses in it, all looking to be eliminated or confirmed as links to where the art is now. In the 1994 Crime Act, Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts added a provision that made it a federal crime to steal, receive, or dispose of any cultural object worth more than $100,000. It also extended the statute of limitations to 20 years for the interstate moving of stolen property and the receiving of stolen property across state lines. That was a vast improvement over just a 5-year statute of limitations on the moving of stolen property. But even the longer limit has now expired. Leads appeared, leads petered out. If David Turner knew anything, he would not likely have been silent during his 21 years spent in prison. Turner was set to be released in 2025, but because of a change in federal sentencing guidelines, the judge who originally sent Turner to prison vacated his sentence in 2019 and gave him 3 years of probation. He walked out a free man. The first question he was asked was what he knew about the Gardner. The heist moved American museums to make the security of their facilities a priority, so that men like Abbott and Heston, benign caretakers at best, were replaced by trained professionals. Rich Abbott died in February 2024 at age 57. Before his death, he told NPR he didn't wish to be remembered alone for the mistake he made one night in 1990 after buzzing two men into the private museum. He said, quote, "It's the kind of thing most people don't have to learn to cope with. It's like doing penance. It's always there," end quote. A lot of people whose names were associated, rightly or wrongly, with this crime have died, most in horrible ways. That was maybe more a function of how they lived than where they were or what they knew on March 18, 1990. It's for that reason a lot of people don't think this crime will ever be solved. The best they can hope for is that one or more of the 13 pieces just shows up in someone's attic someday. So why does it matter? An art crime may seem victimless, and nobody died that night, but who we are and what we are is tied up in all that those things represent. Art is all the beauty that man is able to create, and to lose it is to strip us all of something rare and pure. It denies us an experience which I think is as near to heaven as we'll all likely get. As for the Gardner heist, the FBI still considers the crime an open case. To research this case, journalist Amy Wilson and her mother visited the Gardner Museum in the early 1980s before the heist. Little did she know that she was doing research then. The courtyard there was as memorable as the art. Amy also read The Gardner Heist, the true story of the world's largest unsolved art theft by Ulrich Boser, perused Master Thieves by Stephen Kirkagian, watched This Is a Robbery, a four-part Netflix documentary, and read the continuing saga of the crime and its aftermath in 34 years of newspaper and arts journal reporting. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rassman and Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Ben Scoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're at centuriespod, and check out our Crimes of the Centuries podcast Facebook page.